This podcast contains graphic content and discusses themes of violence. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Hi, everybody. You are listening to the Living Podcast, where the dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about. I'm your host, Jen Hansen, and today's case is about a serial killer who flew under the radar, undetected by friends and family, for years, until it became too late for those around him. This is the life and crimes of Carl Charlie Brandt. Michelle Jones was a successful 37-year-old living in Orlando, Florida, working as a top executive for the Golf Channel. As the only daughter to Bill and Mary Lou Jones, Michelle was loved and doted on, particularly by her father and her older brother, Sean. Graduating from the University of Florida, Michelle started her life off on the right foot and made something of herself. She bought a house with a pool and a hot tub and settled into a happy single life with her dogs. Michelle was close with her Aunt Terry, who was Mary Lou's sister. The two were only 8 years apart and essentially grew up together. Though Terry lived 4 hours away in the Florida Keys with her husband, Charlie, the two were always in touch. The distance didn't matter much since Michelle was so much more like a friend to Terry and Charlie than a niece. In September of 2004, the dynamic between Michelle, her Aunt Terry, and Uncle Charlie would change forever. The Florida Keys were being evacuated ahead of Hurricane Ivan, and Michelle offered for Terry and Charlie to make the drive to Orlando where they could wait out the storm. What began as a fun weekend spent with family, catching up and having drinks, would turn into a double murder, a suicide, and the world wondering how anyone let things get this far. Carl Charlie Brandt was born on February 23, 1957, to parents Herbert and Ilsa Brandt. Charlie was the second child of Herbert and Ilsa, and the only boy the couple would have. Due to Herbert's work as an engineer, the family moved around often, never staying in one place for too long and making it difficult for Charlie and his older sister Angela to make friends. Charlie in particular struggled with the frequent moves and had a hard time adjusting to each new school. Eventually, though, the family settled in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Charlie was able to grasp onto some stability. Family life seemed normal for everybody, and the Brandts vacationed often in Florida where Charlie and his dad took up hunting. This was a way, according to Herbert, to, quote, toughen up Charlie, as his father saw him as too soft. Ilsa gave birth to two more girls, and in 1970, she became pregnant with their fifth baby. Everything seemed perfect. Now, it's important to note here that the order you're hearing this case in is not the same order that it has been told through the media. You're going to hear it now in the chronological order that it all unfolded. The reason for this is because the Living Podcast, as you may already know, has a focus on criminal and forensic psychologies. To tell this particular case out of order feels like it would be a disservice to you as the listener, as you wouldn't be able to see and follow the psychological madness of a mind that was determined to kill. At 13 years old, Charlie began experiencing common difficulties that most teenagers run into during puberty, which began taking a toll on his mental health. One incident, however, that no child should have to experience occurred on an annual family Christmas trip to Florida. Herbert and Charlie were out hunting when Herbert shot and killed the family dog in front of Charlie. It's unclear if this event triggered something in the young teen, but it would later be brought up by Herbert to police. We'll come back to this later, so put a pin in that for now. Days later, in January of 1971, the Brandt home was winding down in the early evening. The two youngest Brandt daughters were asleep in their rooms, and Angela had taken a book upstairs to read in bed. Ilsa, who was 8 months pregnant, was taking a bath while Herbert joined her in the bathroom to get ready for bed.
I haven't told this story. I can't remember when.
This is Investigator Rob Hemmert with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office, the person being interviewed. is Angela, and the last name is Brandt. That's right.
Okay, I'm okay.
All right.
It was January 3rd, 1971.
Charlie was 13?
Yes.
And Angela, you were how old?
15.
15. Tell me again what took place and what was going on.
9, 10 p.m.
Okay.
We had just gotten a color TV.
Right.
So we were all sitting around watching the FBI, you know, Effins and Bliss Jr. and all that.
Okay.
The FBI was over. We went upstairs. I went and got in bed to read my book like I always did before I went to sleep.
Okay.
My mom ran a bath and read Time magazine. My dad was shaving.
Okay. So you're in your bed reading, and what happens next?
I heard loud noises, which I perceived to be firecrackers.
Okay.
For the simple reason, not that that makes any sense.
That's all right.
But, I mean, you know, I just, sure. What other loud noise is there?
Popping.
Yeah, just a really loud noise. And I just, like I said, I just thought it was firecrackers. So I started pulling the covers back to see why on earth, you know, there was all this noise going on. But then I heard my father yell, Charlie, don't, or Charlie, stop. And my mom was just screaming, and the last thing I ever heard my mom say was, Angela, call the police.
So what happened after that?
So, as I said, I was removing the covers from my bed and getting out of the bed, and all this took place in split seconds.
Okay.
I mean, this has got to be less than a minute, I would think, okay?
Right.
And I get up, and as I'm getting up, he comes into my room.
Charlie.
Okay. Brandishing the gun, I didn't even realize what it really was. I mean, until he aimed it at me and he pulled the trigger.
Okay, so you hear it click.
I could hear it click.
Okay.
And I guess when he realized the gun didn't have any more bullets, that must be what he threw it on the floor. And as I said, I was lucid enough to kick it under the bed. I didn't know if it had any bullets in it or not. I don't even know what was going on.
Right.
And then a physical altercation ensued. I imagine, I think he struck me. I do. I think he, because I had blood and just bruises, and I fought back. This is the only physical altercation I've ever been in my entire life,
okay?
And I guess I won because I'm here to tell about it. I don't know.
Right.
And I remember I was only 15. My brain was trying to assimilate what was going on, and I was trying to get away from him at the same time. He was very strong. Next thing I know that I can remember is I was laying flat on my back. My bed was right here.
On the bed?
No, on the floor.
Okay.
Probably he knocked me to the floor. I don't know.
Okay.
And he was sitting on me and he was strangling me.
Okay.
I was drifting in and out. I don't think that I got him off of me physically.
All right.
The way I remember it is I saw the weird look on his face, the madness, the glazed over look.
Okay.
I saw it disappear. He just looked more like himself, and he said, what am I doing? Or what have I done? And I remember perfectly saying, I don't know, but I think you shot Dad. Because I heard my dad yelling, Charlie, don't do that, or Charlie, stop. And he said, oh, I did, or whatever. I said, I don't know, but get off of me so we can figure it out, okay? And he did. He got off of me. My next step, I was trying to get out of the house. He goes, so you're not going to leave me, are you? Of course. I said, no.
Sorry.
No, I would run out the door. And I did. As soon as I thought he was far enough away, I ran. Have you ever seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Yeah.
I saw it once in my life. I could never watch it again. You know the girl screaming?
Yeah.
The way she ran screaming? That was me. I was just a little girl. I was running through the snow in my bloody nightgown, torn, just screaming. I got to the first house right across the street. I didn't knock on the door. I turned the knob and it was locked. And then I ran to the next house. And by the time I got to the next house, my brother had apparently come down the steps. He was outside. And all my life, I've heard him screaming after me, Angie, you promised you wouldn't leave me. You promised you wouldn't leave me. But I did.
Herbert had been shot first, at point-blank range in the back. But he survived. Ilsa and the unborn baby would not be so lucky, sustaining multiple gunshot wounds that killed them both. Due to Charlie's age, no criminal charges could be pressed against him. Instead, He underwent 3 separate psychiatric evaluations to determine the best course of treatment. All 3 psychiatrists who evaluated Charlie said they could not find a mental illness or root cause for the murder. According to the CBS News 48 Hours special on Charlie called Deadly Obsession, one psychiatrist said of his findings, quote, "We found no psychosis, no distorted thinking that would basically be a reason for this crime to be done," end quote. Charlie was sent to a psychiatric hospital where he spent a full year before his time in psych care ended. And let's be clear about the phrase, before his time ended. Charlie was never formally released from the hospital. In fact, at the time, there were no clear laws in Indiana about holding minors. So, Herbert petitioned the courts to let Charlie come home. And what do you know? They just let him go. Because of his age, there were never any charges against Charlie for his mother's death, and the records were officially sealed. The younger sisters of Charlie were later told their mother died in a car accident, as they were too young to have remembered the incident or known otherwise what happened. Not long after Charlie was brought back home, his father moved the family to Ormond Beach, Florida. The following year, Herbert Brandt remarried and moved with his new wife and his 2 younger daughters back to Indiana. An arrangement was made at that time to keep Angela and Charlie in Florida with their grandparents. Now, let's fast forward about 10 years, because the rest of Charlie's teenage life was pretty unremarkable. In 1984, he graduated college with a bachelor's in electronics and became an engineer. He ended up working long-term as a radar technician who operated a landmark surveillance blimp, according to the Orlando Sentinel. Charlie's sister Angela had married a man named Jim Graves, who became fast friends with Charlie. They were so close, in fact, that when the pair got divorced some years later, Jim and Charlie remained close friends. During the marriage, Angela had told Jim about the murder of her mother, and despite being surprised by it, Jim stood by his friend and didn't question anything. Charlie had grown to be such a successful, happy, and seemingly well-adjusted adult, there wasn't a need to worry. Or so he thought. That opinion of Jim's would begin to change on a fishing trip Jim and Charlie took together a few weeks after Angela filed for divorce. What began as a standard lake outing turned into something darker. Jim, feeling crestfallen about losing his wife, confided in Charlie how he wished Angela could feel the same heartbreak he was feeling. Charlie did not comfort him and empathize as he had expected him to do. According to Jim in the book Invisible Killer, Charlie looked up at Jim slowly and said, quote, "If you really want to get revenge, you should kill somebody and cut their heart out," end quote. Jim was, of course, taken aback by this, but he chose to let it go and assumed Charlie was only joking. Remember, Jim had been married to Charlie's sister, Angela. The same sister Charlie tried to shoot and strangle the night he killed his mom and shot his dad. It's unclear if Jim considered this when hearing Charlie's advice, but what he noticed next didn't exactly put his mind at ease. Charlie was a skilled fisher. He had learned everything there was to know about it during some time he spent working in the Bahamas. But Charlie began gutting his catches in a way that Jim hadn't seen him do before, with an almost surgical-like precision down the length of the fish. Even more unsettling was that Charlie preferred to do so while the fish was still alive before they got back home. Now, regardless of whatever Jim felt about Charlie in that moment, it didn't change anything between them. In fact, a few years later, Jim suspected Charlie was just lonely and asked his girlfriend Nancy if she had any friends to set him up with. During Charlie's work in the Bahamas, he had found a duffel bag filled with cocaine and sold it off to make $500,000. By the way, in 1985, when that happened, that amount of money was equal to over $1.2 million today. Knowing this, Nancy told her friend Terry about Charlie, and she was immediately intrigued. Terry and Charlie hit it off. And when I say that, I mean they hit it off. As their relationship became more serious and Charlie considered proposing, Angela insisted he tell Terry about his past. Charlie's first reaction was one that surprised Angela, and later Jim, who also encouraged him to tell Terry about the murder of his mother. It was a stern no. He didn't bother to give it a second thought or consider how it might affect their relationship. She wasn't to know, and that was the end of it. But Jim and Angela didn't let up. Charlie had proposed to Terry. The pressure was on and Charlie felt it. He knew it was a big decision, but he couldn't risk Terry leaving him. So instead, they married in a small spur-of-the-moment ceremony where no family had been invited. Terry's sister Mary Lou took it hard, but Terry simply told her that she wanted her there but didn't feel it was fair to invite one member of the family and not the others. Mary Lou later told Dr. Phil that she didn't even question it, as she trusted Terry to make the right decisions for her own life. Besides, the longer the couple was married, the happier Charlie was. Terry brought out an energetic and fun-loving side of him that no one had seen before. Jim told the authors of Invisible Killer that they even made each other's lunches every day because, quote, "lunch tasted better when it was made by the one who loved you." But it worked for them. The pair built a houseboat in Big Pine Key, Florida, and lived their married life without their honeymoon phase really ever ending. Everyone who knew them thought they were the perfect match. They were always happy to be around one another, and they spent all of their free time fishing and camping together. But for as blissful as their marriage was, Terry was beginning to suspect Charlie may not have been the man she believed him to be. In 1993, the couple joined their friend Nancy to see Jim's band play. Between his sets, Jim joined them all at their table, and the four of them enjoyed a laid-back evening at the bar. Nancy recalls Terry seeming anxious, something that was unusual coming from Terry. So when Charlie got up to use the restroom, Nancy took that as an opportunity to ask what was going on. She told her two friends that not long before that night, she walked into her and Charlie's garage to find him covered in blood. Charlie tried to explain it away by saying he was simply gutting fish, but Charlie hadn't been fishing recently. And there were no catches in the garage there with him. In his interview with Dr. Phil, Jim recalls trying to talk Terry down, stating that big fish can sometimes cause big messes, and if it got filleted wrong, it could have made a mess and had to be thrown out. But we all know how Charlie liked to gut them, with that surgical precision while he was still at the lake and while they were still alive. Terry went on to confess that she had heard about a missing woman's body who was recently found, a woman by the name of Sherry Parishow. She thought Charlie had killed her, and the day she found him covered in blood, she assumed was the day he had committed murder. Jim talked her out of calling the police, bringing into question if it was worth potentially ending their marriage over. Because if Charlie was innocent, Jim wondered how he might react knowing his wife accused him of such an atrocity. Jim did recall later asking Charlie if he knew his wife suspected him, to which he very quietly replied, "I didn't do it." There was no further conversation about it. But keep Sherry in your back pocket for now, and we'll come back to her soon. Let's fast forward again to 2004. Terry and Charlie had been married for 17 years, and despite the worry about her husband potentially being a murderer, even though he was, but she didn't know anything about that, their life carried on as normal and they continued to be happy together. That was until Hurricane Ivan was about to make waves. Let's recall the beginning of this when we introduced Terry and her niece Michelle. Michelle was Mary Lou's daughter, and Terry was close with both of them. Michelle lived up north in Maitland, where the hurricane wasn't projected to hit. So when she saw the news that Big Pine Key was being evacuated ahead of the storm, she called up her aunt and uncle and invited them to stay with her for the weekend until the storm passed. The Brants made the four-hour drive from the Keys to Orlando, grateful for the shelter. Before they left, however, and this is important, so stay with me, even if it doesn't make sense right now, Charlie boarded up every door and window with more precision than a skilled carpenter. Stick a pin in that, we'll come back to it. When Terry and Charlie made it to Michelle's home, they were met with open arms. Michelle's friends knew the couple well and had planned to stop by during their stay. They were everyone's aunt and uncle, so the weekend was bound to be full of catching up and hanging out, exactly what Terry had hoped for. One of Charlie's younger sisters, Jessica, who had been an infant when he killed their mother, lived near Michelle in Orlando. After they arrived and settled for a couple of days at Michelle's house, they took a trip over to Jessica's to spend time with her and their father, Herbert. This was Sunday, September 12th. Throughout the time they spent at Jessica's house, Charlie seemed, to everyone, to be a bit more emotional and open. He willingly reminisced with his family and laughed more than usual. It was slightly uncharacteristic, as Charlie was usually laid back and stoic. Jessica would later recall to 48 Hours how Charlie hugged she and her dad more tightly than usual. At some point in the evening, Jessica and Charlie phoned Angela to catch up with her together. When Jessica went to tend to the dinner she was making, Charlie and Angela continued to speak. Angela recalls to the authors of Invisible Killer how there was an insistence in his voice, a desperation when he said he wanted to go home. Charlie and Terry were scheduled to leave the following day, so it seemed odd that Charlie couldn't wait it out through the night. And knowing how close he and Terry were with Michelle, this confused her even more. But she thought maybe he was homesick, or that the storm just had him on edge. Whatever it was, she tried not to be worried about it, but it stuck with her. And it wouldn't be too long before she understood why. The following day, that Monday, Michelle's friend Debbie was planning to stop by the house for dinner. She grew up along with Michelle, so having Terry and Charlie around was exciting, and she wanted to see them. The pair had been scheduled to head home that day, but something in Charlie had changed. Though he had been eager and desperate to leave the day before, he begged Terry to stay one more night. Speaking with Jessica, Terry told her how upset she was that Charlie didn't even give her much of a choice. Their suitcases had been packed and were waiting by the door, but Charlie put his foot down and said they were staying. Michelle ended up calling Debbie and telling her not to come by. Charlie had a lot to drink that evening, and he and Terry were still arguing. Debbie recalled to 48 Hours that Michelle didn't want her to feel uncomfortable, and Debbie understood. She told Michelle she'd stop by the next day, Tuesday, before the couple headed back down south. But that visit would never come. Debbie never heard from Michelle about when to stop by that following day. Assuming it still wasn't a pleasant environment if Charlie and Terry were still arguing, she didn't want to push and decided she would just wait to hear from Michelle. Mary Lou, if you'll remember, Michelle's mom and Terry's sister, was in daily contact with her daughter. Michelle was never one to leave her mom hanging and always picked up the phone when she called or texted her back when she wrote. It kept her mind at ease since she lived 8 hours away in North Carolina. That weekend was no different. That was until Tuesday evening. Mary recalls to Dr. Phil how she called after she assumed her sister and brother-in-law had gone home, but Michelle's phone went straight to voicemail. No alarm bells were set off just yet. Mary Lou didn't think much of it and thought maybe Michelle had gone to bed early that night. But when Wednesday morning rolled around and she got Michelle's voicemail again, she became worried. She called Debbie, who she knew had a spare key to Michelle's house, and asked her to go check to see if everything was all right. But the moment Debbie pulled up, she knew something was wrong. Charlie and Terry's Subaru was still parked in the driveway, although they were supposed to have left the day before, since Terry was due back at work that Wednesday. When Debbie got to the door, she knocked. There wasn't a single sound from inside, not even the bark of Michelle's small dog, which could always be expected when a visitor arrived. With an ever-evolving knot in her stomach, Debbie waited a minute and then knocked again, this time more frantically. Still no sound, no movement, no lights on. She frantically searched for the spare key in her bag and tried the lock, but it wouldn't budge. She ran around the outside of the house, peering into the windows to see if she could make out anything inside. But uncharacteristically of Michelle, the blinds had all been closed. When Debbie circled around to the opposite side of the house and made it to the garage, the real panic set in. Through the glass windows at the top of the garage door, she could see Charlie, hanging by a bedsheet from the ceiling. A panicked 911 call was made, and the police were there in minutes. Lead detective on the scene, Ryan Hemmert, recalls how decomposed Charlie's body had been after only 2 days. The Florida heat had no mercy, and the smell was hard for even a seasoned investigator like him to stomach. Debbie gave her key to Detective Hemmert and advised how it wouldn't open. But this time it worked. It might have been her panic that prevented her from being able to open the lock, or maybe it was divine intervention. But once she learned what horrors were inside, she would be glad that key wouldn't turn. Hemmert told 48 Hours how he couldn't have been prepared for what awaited him inside the house. Terry's body was sat upright on the couch, wearing only her underwear and a yellow t-shirt. She was dead. Upon further investigation, they would find that she had been stabbed 7 times in the chest. As gruesome as this sounds, she was the lucky one. Investigators found Michelle in the back of the house in her bedroom. I should say, they found what was left of her. Scattered around the room was Michelle's underwear. But not just any underwear. Specifically, all the items that she owned from Victoria's Secret. Everything else was left neatly in her dresser. More to come on this. Michelle had been posed. Her headless body had been positioned to sit upright on her bed. Her decapitated head was on the bedside table next to her body, as if she had been made to watch what would happen to the rest of her. But that wasn't all. Michelle's left leg had been removed at her hip. Her breasts had been removed and were left out on the bed along with her leg. Her intestines were found in a garbage can. The autopsy findings revealed the removal of those body parts had been done with a surgical precision. And that led investigators to believe this was not Charlie's first time killing. Of course, they pulled his records and tried to find anything that might indicate that he'd killed before. But there was nothing. And if you'll remember, the killing of his mother had been sealed. The clip that was played early on in the episode of Angela was from the day she went to Detective Hemmert and told him about Charlie's past. No one knew anything about the murder of their mother until then. Armed with this new information, Hemmert and his team set out to uncover more. The first stop in their investigation was Terry and Charlie's home in Big Pine Key, and what they found would begin to crack their investigation wide open. Upon entering the Brants' bedroom, they found an anatomy poster hung on the back of the bedroom door. It showed a woman with a sagittal cut down her body. Half of her was the skeletal system, and the other half was the muscular system. Neither of them had any medical training or jobs in related fields. Along with the anatomy poster, they found numerous anatomy books, medical journals, and surgery textbooks. And that brings us back to one of the pins you were supposed to hold on to. Take a moment to think back on Charlie's preferred method of gutting his catches, as well as the obsessively precise way he boarded their house up prior to the storm. He had a fascination, a hobby, of studying surgical books. He did not gut fish or board up his house that way to be sufficient. He did it as practice. Among those things recovered in the Brant home were internet searches for necrophilia and pornography that featured violence against women and death fantasies. He also had a mass collection of snuff films saved on his computer. Still, that wasn't all. Hemmert's team of investigators found a box of Victoria's Secret catalogs addressed to Charlie. Now, you may be thinking back to the underwear of Michelle's littered around her room. Charlie clearly had an obsession. And yes, part of it was with Victoria's Secret for whatever reason. But it all went back to Michelle. After the murders, a former coworker of Charlie's came out to speak with police. He informed them that he always thought Michelle's name was Victoria, because when Charlie spoke of her, that's what he called her. And he spoke of her often. This coworker, who has not been named, told Hemmert that he seemed like more than just a friendly uncle talking about his niece. He seemed obsessed. And clearly that was true. Detectives set out to look over cold cases that could be linked to Charlie. What they didn't realize was that it would be much more of a daunting task than they could have realized. Upon their investigation, they noticed that Charlie traveled for work. And he traveled a lot. The number of murders he could have committed would be impossible to pin down. But luckily, Charlie kept a very detailed log of all of his travels and mileage. But while this helped narrow things down a bit, there was still a nearly insurmountable number of murders to sift through. Upon hearing from Jim Graves about Terry's fears that he had murdered Sherry Parisho, that was the first one they dove into. And just like that, Terry's fears were confirmed. Sherry's throat had been slashed so deeply, she had nearly been decapitated. Her heart had been removed and was never found. There were never any suspects tied to her murder, only a composite sketch done of a man a witness saw running from the area near Sherry's houseboat in Big Pine Key. Her body was recovered in 1989 in a body of water by a fisherman less than 1,000 feet from Charlie and Terry's home. With all the information detectives were able to put together, they officially closed Sherry's case in 2006 and announced to the public they were satisfied in believing Charlie Brandt was her killer. One other case that has officially been linked to Charlie was the murder of Darlene Toler. In 1995, her body was found wrapped in plastic. She was missing her head and her heart. She was discovered next to a highway that Charlie used to travel often. In fact, his meticulous travel log showed 100 miles on a day he wasn't working, and those 100 miles driven were logged as driving to Miami and back, the exact distance to the location her body was found, and along the same highway it was found dumped off the side of. Detective Hemmert reached out to criminal profiler Leslie D'Ambrosia to help sort through the other cold cases that might have some connection. When speaking to 48 Hours, D'Ambrosia told interviewers, quote, "There's no boilerplate profile for a serial killer. It doesn't exist. It's all individual. It's based on a person's life experiences, and everyone has a different life experience," end quote. And that is true. Charlie lived his life in a way that shielded everyone from his dark side. With the exception of Terry worried that he killed Sherry Parisho, she continued to be married to him and not question him again. It's very possible this could all go back to his childhood, before he killed his mother. Before we go forward with Charlie's psychology, please know I am not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but I am a student majoring in forensic psychology with a minor in criminal psychology, and I have conducted a lot of research for this episode. Court records from the 1971 shooting of his parents were released after the 2004 murders. In interviews with detectives back then, Charlie confessed he knew he wanted to shoot them during dinner that evening. Though Charlie had, by all accounts, been described as a mama's boy, she berated him that night at dinner for not doing his homework. So after their family meal, when everyone else got to retreat to the living room to watch their brand new color TV, Charlie had to stay behind to work on a school project. Sneaking out of the kitchen and upstairs to his parents' bedroom, Charlie pulled his father's handgun out of the dresser and quietly crept back downstairs. He hid the gun under his textbook and waited. He waited until one by one, the family began heading upstairs to get ready for bed. He waited until his mother was in the bath, his father was grooming before bed, and his sister was reading. He waited until everyone was in their most vulnerable state before he struck. Recall, if you will, Earlier in the episode, when we talked about how Herbert shot Charlie's dog on a hunting trip to toughen him up. This was only a few days prior to those early shootings. Psychologists in Switzerland conducted a study on what happens to the brain when the thought of revenge seeps in. In this study, psychologists asked pairs of people to play an economic game with them, encouraging one of the pairs in secret to dupe their partner out of money. Naturally, the partner who was cheated became upset. The psychologists offered a way in the game to punish the other player. They were given one full minute to determine if they wanted to do so. And during that time, the person's brain was scanned to see if there was anything that could be detected. To the researcher's surprise, the thought of revenge caused a rush of neural activity in the reward center of the brain. This occurred in every single participant who was offered the option to punish their partner for stealing in the game. So does that mean that Charlie, already hurting and upset from the death of his dog, only to later feel humiliation at the scolding from his mother, decided ahead of time to punish his parents? Did that rush of pleasure in the brain make him decide that he needed to make them feel sorry for what they did to him? According to the psychologists who conducted this study, it's likely. Especially since they determined based on the brain scan that the pleasureful feeling in the brain was only temporary. They call it the just desserts effect. Basically, the revenge is a sugarcoating. The idea seems promising when you're still reeling from whatever hurt you, but as soon as the action is carried out, that feeling flees and you're left with the consequences of your actions, whatever they may be. Further, these psychologists deemed that in the wrong person, revenge can escalate even after the just desserts effect has long gone. This could explain Charlie's need to continue to kill long after the shooting death of his mother. This also aligns with the classic serial killer trope of escalation. In the same way that substance abuse continues to keep reaching the same high, the way revenge triggers the reward center of the brain has a similar effect. It's possible that Charlie continued to seek out the feeling he felt getting revenge on his parents. We also know Charlie struggled maintaining friendships and connections due to the family moving around a lot when he was young. Researchers Rebecca Coley and Melissa Cole followed 25 families across 15 years in which the parents moved their children multiple times. Their findings were that with each move the family made, the social skills of the children decline, putting families that move more than 4 times between the child's age of 4 and 19 at the highest risk for developing antisocial personality disorder. Dr. Shigeru Oishi, PhD, took on the task of following up with the study participants later in life between the ages of 25 and 70 and found, quote, "The more times people moved as children, the more likely they were to report lower life satisfaction and psychological well-being at the time they were surveyed," end quote. Of course, there are some killers who simply do just that. Kill. Could Charlie's childhood trauma be to blame? Many people had bad childhoods who don't go out and decapitate people and cut their hearts out. But that's why Charlie Brandt was the invisible killer. He fooled everyone. Profiler Leslie D'Ambrosia says of Charlie's crimes, quote, "Charlie's trademark was precision and a methodical technique. How a person normally behaves is translated into how they carry their crimes out. He's quite organized and planned in what he does. He's intelligent, very reliable, very responsible," end quote. Charlie Brandt wrecked the lives of everyone he knew. He robbed his siblings of a mother, 2 families of their daughters, and the lives they should have been living. He robbed his wife of a secure future, and his niece of ever knowing true safety from a family member she should have been able to trust. He left more damage in his wake than he could have ever known, and selfishly didn't even care to think about. Charlie Brandt, in his final act of complete egocentrism, and in the true nature of a family annihilator, killed his wife over his obsession with his niece, because he thought she'd be better off than to live with the knowledge of what he did to her. And to top it all off, he couldn't even stick around to face what he had done like the coward he truly is. In welcoming Terry to the family, Angela recalls telling her what a special person he was. She said, quote, "Charlie told you about himself, and you married him anyway." She, of course, was referring to the shooting of his parents. Perhaps Terry thought she was joking as she just smiled and hugged Angela. Telling 48 Hours about that moment, she recalls thinking how happy she was that Terry accepted him and that they were going to live happily ever after. Thank you guys so much for listening. I know it's been a while, but I'm happy to be back and hopefully start bringing you regularly occurring episodes. If this isn't your first time here, I'm sure you've noticed the format has changed a little bit. Let me know what you think. I'm open to suggestions. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review on whatever platform you listen on. I'll be back soon with a brand new episode. But in the meantime, remember,
the dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.